months since the events of 7th of October, where a number of Palestinian resistance groups launched an assault into southern Israel. And Israel's now responded with a broad invasion of the Gaza Strip. And the images that continue to beam out have led to much criticism of Israel due to the mounting civilian casualties. I think the numbers are now over 9,000 people, 9,000 civilians dead in Gaza. There's a lot of questions that need to be asked. What is Israel's endgame? Is the two-state solution still on the table? We find that the public opinion is shifting. Is it turning against Israel? Is this going to be a lasting opinion? And who's winning the information war? These are some of the questions we've received from you guys on social media here at The Geopolity. And I'm sitting down with Geopolity founder Adnan Khan to look at these questions and where we are a month on. So Adnan, let's get straight into it. What's happened in the last 4 weeks? What are the key issues we need to be aware of?
So Yusuf, as you mentioned, it's been a month, which is quite a long time, and what's happened in that month. So 7th of October, we know was the assault from Hamas and around, I think, 10 or 11 other groups. And what you found straight away, Yusuf, was Israel used the sympathy in global public opinion to launch an assault on the Gaza Strip. And, you know, Israel made it very clear they're not hiding this, that they wanted blood. So terms like we want to remove Hamas, we want to kick them out into the desert, regime change, you know, they want blood. That was made very clear. So eventually what we saw was some sort of strategy and plan put out in the public realm. So their strategy seems to be, or what they're publicly saying, is they want to destroy Hamas. They want to remove Hamas from power. So regime change effectively. And straight away we saw an air assault begin. So obviously we've seen the images coming out from Palestine or historic Palestine. So hospitals are being attacked, refugee buildings are being attacked, churches, mosques, schools, all of these being bombed. So around 2 weeks ago, the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, they began an incursion into the north of Gaza after telling everyone that they need to leave their homes and move to the south of the Gaza Strip. Currently, Yusuf, the IDF is surrounding Gaza City, which I think is the most populous area in the Gaza Strip. And that's really where we are now. So that massive ground invasion hasn't happened, and I'm sure we're going to discuss that. Really, what we're seeing around the world is just a mass carnage. The rubble, hospitals being bombed. Schools, you know, what we would consider civilian targets. So, you know, a month's gone by, it seems like a long time. In the grand scheme of things, we are really still in the early days. Obviously, in the first few days, Israel made it very clear that it's going to launch an unprecedented assault. And despite that, we haven't seen this unprecedented ground invasion Israel was talking about. So, you know, after 4 weeks, the ground incursion has begun. Obviously, we're seeing massive devastation. But that is where we are after 4 weeks.
It's interesting that you say that they were planning an unprecedented attack, and you think that that hasn't actually started, because from what we see on the media, social media, it's absolutely chaos. The destruction is something that I've never witnessed before. I wanted to talk about, do you know, some of the comments by the Israeli politicians. Many people would say that it amounts to calls for genocide. What do you make of that? Is that what Israel is trying to do? What's the end game here?
Israeli officials, one after the other, are making very clear what they think and feel about the Palestinian people and really what they want to get out of this. And I would say, Yusuf, they actually are not saying anything they've not said before. The only difference is when they said things that sounded genocidal, it never really got media attention. Now it's getting media attention because of the devastation we're witnessing, and many people are horrified. But I would say, Yusuf, Zionists and Israeli officials have actually been pretty consistent that they want to expel the indigenous people, that they don't really want a two-state solution. And now they've got an opportunity. So a couple of days in, a think tank from Israel said we now have the opportunity to implement the final solution, which is quite shocking. However, they've said that previously. It's not actually new. So what you find, Yusuf, is they're being very clear, Israeli officials. Even yesterday, Yusuf, I think the heritage minister, he said that we should just nuke the Gaza Strip. Yeah, we've had the defense minister, when he started the war, he said these are human animals. So these genocidal Nazi-esque type statements, these are not new. They've always been there, but the Western media have generally not given it attention. Now they are. And it does beg the question, why would Israeli officials say this in public, even if they feel it in private? I'm sure we're going to discuss that. So in terms of the end game, Youssef, so Western leaders continue to say that Israel has the right to defend itself, which in effect means they can continue doing what they're doing. But the wide scale and the depth of slaughter, it's raised some serious questions. The wide-scale destruction, Youssef, that is a introduction to Israel's endgame. So I mentioned this leaked document. It's a leaked document. So the Israeli Intelligence Ministry, which is a government ministry, it actually recommended the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, with the 2.3 million Palestinian population expelled and pushed out into the Sinai Desert, which Egypt runs. And I would say, Youssef, this has actually been a Zionist agenda really going back to 1948. And as we've already discussed, the dehumanizing statements, they're really just coming thick and fast. Netanyahu last week, in a speech, he summarized the conflict as children of light, Israel, versus the children of darkness. And this was after the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital was actually bombed. Netanyahu gave another speech last week where he likened the Palestinian people to Amalek. And that is, historically, Amalek's attacked Israelites. So Netanyahu was using biblical invocations that that's a struggle they're actually in. And, you know, this goes back to when George W. Bush said during the Iraq War that they were in a crusade. So, you know, this genocidal, apocalyptic type narrative, this is the Israeli narrative. This is the Zionist narrative. This is what's going on here. That's why, Yusuf, it doesn't make sense. You've got 2 million-ish people in the Gaza Strip. Israel has some of the best intelligence gathering surveillance technology in the world. It can, to give you a simple example, Yusuf, the Gaza Strip's telephone towers, the towers that connect your telephones and your devices, none of them are in Gaza. They're on the outside of Gaza, which Israel controls and maintains. Every phone call, every text message, every internet connection, Israel knows. They're the one that manage that for the Gaza Strip. So with all this technology, why are you bombing schools? Why are you bombing hospitals? Why are you bombing infrastructure, which is necessary for people to live as a society? Hospitals, schools, businesses, neighborhoods, refugee centers. And the only conclusion you can come to is the objective here isn't Hamas. The objective is much broader. And it is genocidal. And the Israeli officials aren't hiding that. When you're using biblical stories where whole people were wiped out, when you're talking about nuking a whole area, really, that's your endgame. And again, just to finish, Youssef, I will say this isn't new. It may be new for a lot of people. It may be quite horrific for them to hear. But Israel's founders, the founders of the Zionist movement, Israel's original political leaders, subsequent Israeli political leaders have actually been very open that they want the whole of Palestine. In fact, they want more than Palestine. And the people that are there, they do plan the expulsion of the people. That is the Israeli endgame, and they're very open about this.
This endgame that you talk about, I mean, we see a lot of posts flying around. So there was one that I came across a few days ago that Israel offered Egypt large sums of money to clear their debt in order to accept the Palestinians in the Sinai. Also plans to annex Gaza. And you talk about their plans are actually beyond what they want of Israel. They actually go further out than that. How likely is it that the international community, particularly the US, would be accepting of that?
So this is where there actually is a clear difference between Israeli interests and American interests. Now, I know Zionists like to paint American and Israeli interests the same. But they're actually not. They're two different countries. Their interests do overlap in many areas, but actually there are some major differences. So on Iran, for example, Iran and America have major differences. America has been doing nuclear deals. The Biden administration in talks with the Iranian regime. Israel's always been against this. When the nuclear deal was made back in 2015 under Obama, Israel was completely against it. Now, it's important to remember here, Youssef, that the two-state solution, this was an American plan. This was not an Israeli plan. This was not a Palestinian plan. It wasn't the surrounding Arab nations plan. This was an American plan to solve the problem in the region. Now, originally, Britain had proposed two states or one state, but it never really went further. After the 1967 war, America became very clear that there needs to be two states. And there were a couple of reasons for this. Firstly, America felt that after Israel's 1967 victory, Israel became very arrogant. You had some politicians saying, we don't even need America anymore. They had defeated the Arab armies, and Israel's border stretched all the way to the Suez Canal. They'd taken over the Sinai. They'd taken over the West Bank. They'd taken over the Golan Heights and even part of Lebanon. Israel effectively, through that war, became the regional power. Why do you need America when you're now the regional power? So Israel became very arrogant, and America was the rising power in the Middle East. America doesn't want to share any region with anybody. So in the 1973 war, America stayed on the sidelines until Israel actually believed they're about to be annihilated. So in the 1973 war, both Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Hafez al-Assad of Syria, they launched wars. They got back all the territory they'd lost in the previous war, and they were about to launch an assault now onto Israel proper. So Israel actually believed this is it, we're going to be annihilated now. And they literally went with the begging bowl to America, and America played them along until the last moment America intervened. And there were conditions for this. And the condition was that Israel would give back the territory it seized in 1967, and Israel would accept two states and permanent borders. They were very unhappy with this, but they accepted it, they had no choice. And in return, America would get them normalization deals with some of the surrounding countries. So Israel had no option. Now, obviously, where the final two states would be, where would the borders be, that would be decided later. So what Israel did since then, even though it disagreed with two states, Israel has been building settlements. So the day America said this is where the Palestinian state is going to be, Israel would argue, well, we've had a settlement there for 30, 40 years. So because America is the global power, America's got other priorities in the world. You know, Israel, Palestine is one issue in one region. So the Zionists in Israel, they've been taking advantage of it. They've been slowly building settlements. They've been slowly making the two-state solution unworkable. And that's really where we are now. So from an American perspective, Israel is a good return on investment. Israel is an aircraft carrier for America in the Middle East, as Ariel Sharon and Netanyahu keep reminding us. Israel supports and becomes a tool in American foreign policy in the region. However, when it comes to Israel domestically, there are major differences here. So America doesn't want to undermine Israel because it will make her look weak. And this may motivate the surrounding regimes to do something about Israel. On the other hand, America doesn't want to share the region with Israel. So already, Yusuf, we know Lloyd Austin, the army chief in America, and Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, they've actually been sitting in cabinet meetings in the Israeli government. Literally, America's involved in Israel's war strategy. And that's how America's making sure Israel doesn't go too far. So Israel's been making very clear wants to expel the people. But one of the reasons, Yusuf, we haven't seen a ground invasion yet is because America effectively stopped Israel from doing a ground invasion. You've got America's top general and top diplomats sitting in Israeli cabinet meetings. So what you've had now, Yusuf, is incursions into a Gulf Strip. You've had this air assault going on, where America keeps saying, yeah, Israel has the right to defend itself. But if Israel wanted to completely expel the people, you will send in your 300,000 military and get it over with. The fact they haven't done that isn't out of choice. It's because America has forced them not to do that. And there you're seeing there's actually a difference between America's objectives and Israeli objectives. So what Israel wants to achieve actually goes against American interests. So from an American perspective, it's all about how do you manage Israel. You don't want to undermine it where you show it as weak. On the other hand, when you don't undermine it, the Zionists in Israel keep pushing the borders. And this is the dilemma they have. I mean, it's probably a separate podcast, Yusuf, American-Israeli relations.
You've spoken a little bit about the ground incursions. What is actually Israeli strategy? What happened to the big ground invasion that Netanyahu kept telling us about? I know you mentioned briefly America's involvement in kind of pulling them back, but I would have thought also that it would be a major propaganda problem if Israeli soldiers went full on into Gaza with so many civilians still there.
So Netanyahu and every Israeli official made it very clear in the first few days after the 7th October assault that they are going to launch a ground invasion into the Gaza Strip, and they've called up the reservists of the Israeli Defense Forces, and they're getting ready for this. But very quickly, Lloyd Austin and Antony Blinken, they visited the region, they visited Israel, And actually what you saw, you said there was actually contradictory statements coming out from Israeli officials and these American officials. It seems America was able to thwart the ground invasion. So what we've seen since then, Yusuf, is Israel's been doing more concentrated incursions into the Gaza Strip. So looking at it like this, Yusuf, you could send a couple of hundred troops to go and take over an area, which now means that there's fewer troops and they may need more security and cover. But because you've got fewer troops, there's less targets for the Palestinians to target. But it also means it will take you longer now with the number of troops you've only sent in. If you send your army in, you can use the advantage and multiplier of mass power to impose your will upon the people. So you will take some casualties, but because you've got so many more troops and more firepower, you can just saturate the battleground and take over. That obviously hasn't happened despite everything Israel was saying at the beginning. And my view is America stopped that from actually happening. So a full-scale invasion, effectively, you said the grand invasion is what we're witnessing. This incursion they're doing into certain parts of the Gaza Strip. So what Israel seems to be doing is occupying areas of Gaza. And then when it occupies them, it uses these areas to make further incursions into the interior of Gaza. The air attacks, use of the mass route of civilians, this is still continuing. And now this is really raising a lot of questions by everyone around the world. So Antony Blinken this weekend has been in Israel again. And it's actually what he mentioned. He mentioned again that proportionality, all of these sort of things. So you've got a bit of a mishmash strategy here because Israel's military is integrated into America's defense industry. Israel's military and economy is integrated into American aid. As a result, Israel can't just do what it wants because the purse strings and the supply chain go all the way to America. So as a result, what you're seeing is these targeted incursions. But what's obviously getting most of the media coverage is the air assault that we're seeing. So, you know, you've got a bit of a mishmash strategy here because not everyone is on the same page.
Netanyahu keeps talking about how this will be a long war and he refuses a ceasefire. Is this actually sustainable for Israel? I mean, there's been some figures flying around about how much this is costing Israel daily. Can they actually carry on like this?
So I think we've got to keep in mind, Yusuf, is this isn't like the Iraq-Afghan wars, which are full-scale invasions into foreign countries, you know, supply lines coming to the picture, bases coming to the picture. This is Israel launching an assault into technically its own territory, although, you know, it's an apartheid nation, it's separated this territory. So it's not like they've got to travel further. The problem Israel has is Israel doesn't have the defense industrial base and the economic base like America has. So yes, the longer this goes on, it will stretch Israel. It will lead to tensions within Israel very quickly. I mean, generally when Israel goes to war, you find very quickly they need more arms transfers from America. So yes, if this does go on, they will start to have economic problems. I think public opinion will start to turn against Netanyahu. Already, Yusuf, Netanyahu is public opinion in Israel is very mixed. So the families of the hostages, they are regularly protesting in Tel Aviv. You've got many people in Israel, they feel that Israel should negotiate with Hamas. They've already had previous negotiations over prisoners. What we're finding, Yusuf, is the first week or so, Israel had quite a lot of sympathy. Many were shocked at what happened on 7th of October. But as the images are beamed out of hospitals and neighborhoods being turned to rubble, public opinion is really shifting the other way. What we're seeing though, Yusuf, is the reason why Netanyahu seems to keep saying this will be a long war and the reason why he refuses to accept a ceasefire is he needs to talk to the Israeli audience. And what he's telling the Israeli audience is, yes, we got caught on the back foot on 7th of October, but I am good with security and I will take however long it takes to destroy Hamas and remove them from power. So Netanyahu's only interest in domestic public opinion, he actually doesn't really take into account global public opinion. He should do, because you need global public opinion to justify what you're doing. So that's why they're bombing hospitals and they're saying, yes, we bombed the hospital. Like, they literally don't care about global public opinion. It's about domestic public opinion. They bomb a hospital. The head of the IDF comes out and says, brilliant, we bombed a hospital. he quickly takes down the tweet because they've changed their tune on this, and they say, oh, it was a misfired Palestinian rocket. Now, since Hamas has been in power in Gaza, apparently over 130,000 rockets have been fired from Gaza to Israel. Not one of these rockets have ever fallen in Gaza. All of a sudden, how are rockets not just falling in Gaza, but they're taking out a whole hospital? Like, they're literally just making these things up. But remember, you know, Netanyahu and the Israeli government, there's only one public opinion they've got to consider, which is domestic. Global public opinion doesn't really matter to them. And that's why you find, I'm sure we're going to discuss this, the information war. Some of the stuff Israeli officials are coming out with, it's just like, I mean, unless you think everyone's stupid in the world, are these the best arguments that you've got? So, you know, from a Netanyahu perspective, he's got a lot to prove. And really, domestic public opinion is his main concern, not global public opinion.
We see a major shift in public opinion, obviously with the Muslim world, but even non-Muslims. There's a lot of uproar within the surrounding nations, especially. Can you tell me a little bit more about their response? That's both the people, the population, and the leaders.
So yeah, the Muslim world, the surrounding Muslim countries, and really across the Muslim world, they're up in uproar. We've seen some huge demonstrations. I mean, some of these demos are bigger than what we saw during the Arab Spring. So the Muslims in the Muslim world, so we're talking, what, nearly 2 billion people, they are firmly with their brothers and sisters in Palestine. They're shocked at the images they're seeing. And what you've seen, Yusuf, is very quickly calls have shifted to now the rulers need to intervene. The armies in the Muslim world need to intervene. And what you find, Yusuf, the West and Israel actually don't know how to deal with this. They've never had this before. The Muslim world has never been united or even coordinated a response. What you're seeing here is it's bang out of order what's going on. The Palestinian people are the victims. And what you're seeing is again and again and again, where are the Muslim armies? The Muslim armies need to intervene. So what you've seen, Yusuf, from the rulers, again, like previously, we've seen lots of fighting talk. You saw Erdogan give quite a long speech where he criticized Israel. You've seen the Iranian leadership verbally attack Israel, and they've attacked the West for supporting it. We've seen in other countries, in Egypt, where, you know, he's effectively said, the leader, we support the Palestinians, but, you know, we got to work within the international system. So once again, Yusuf, what we're finding is the people are on one side, and the rulers are diametrically on the other side. The sentiments of both are not aligned. So the rulers, their main priority, Yusuf, is domestic public opinion. They need to ensure, because obviously they're more concerned, Yusuf, about their own seat. They're more concerned about their own throne. And they've got a problem here. They've been normalizing relations with Israel. They've been trying to keep in good relationship with the West, who are supporting Israel. On the other hand, their masses are pro-Palestine. Their masses want to see the liberation of Palestine. So this is the problem they have. They're stuck in the middle. And public opinion is growing. And what the rulers have been doing is, let's criticize Israel, let's criticize the West, but not do anything physically. And that's probably the best way, really, to sum up what the response has been in the broader region.
You do find some response. So, for example, the Houthis from Yemen, they've come out openly and said they have declared war on Israel. Hezbollah recently fired some missiles on Israeli locations. You can maybe clarify that a little bit more. What do you make of this? Can they change the direction of the war in any way?
So Hezbollah, Yusuf, their leader, made a quite a long speech yesterday on Saturday the 4th. And the crux of what he said was Israel shouldn't escalate this war. And if it did escalate this war, then Hezbollah will take this provocation very seriously. So in a way, he said something, but at the same time, he said very little. What we find, Yusuf, is in the north of Israel and the south of Lebanon, there's a whole area between both Israel and Lebanon, which is disputed territory. So Hezbollah has been firing rockets over there. You've seen Israel respond as well. But none of this is beyond what normally occurs there. So it was seen, Yusuf, with Hezbollah, they have got an audience they need to keep happy, because their audience have always said, you know, we're fighting and standing up to Israel. So they're showing them we're doing something, but they've not done anything that escalates more than usual. So what that shows to me, Yusuf, is they're not interested in taking advantage of the problem Israel has. If Hezbollah open up a front in the north, and in the south, Israel's having to fight the Gaza Strip, this will overstretch Israel's military. And the opportunity is there if they want to take it. From everything they've said, Hezbollah, and for everything they're doing, it looks like they don't want to take advantage of this opportunity. I'm not sure why. I mean, there is a lot of issues in Lebanon. Lebanon is a collapsed state. But what you're finding is they are making anti-Israeli statements. They are trying to come across as we're ready for war. But physically, they're not doing anything that shows they are expanding or extending what they normally do. In terms of the Houthis, yes, I think was it on Friday, their leader made a statement that they are actually at war with Israel. Both Israel and America have said that they've intercepted missiles that came from the direction of Yemen. So it's not confirmed at the moment, Yusuf, that these definitely came from the Houthis. The Houthis are taking credit for it. And the reason why I'm saying I'm a bit skeptical is because Yemen to Israel is quite far away. And although the Houthis have shown they have some military and missile capability, but they've got it from Iran, what you find, Yusuf, is this is quite far away from where Yemen is. So I'm not sure it definitely came from them. But more importantly, Yusuf, the Houthis are at war with Saudi Arabia. They share a border with this country. Israel is just too far away from them to make a difference. And the Houthis, you know, you could argue, you know, they are a group strong government now because they effectively control the north of Yemen. So, you know, I wouldn't call them a non-state actor. They are the state, really, even though they're not official. But looking at how far they are in their capabilities, I'm not sure how they can really help materially, that is. Hezbollah obviously could help materially. They could launch an operation. They could fire more deeper into Israel. And I think the question you've got to ask is why they're not doing that. If Israel is your enemy, if you're constantly at war with Israel, Israel now is bogged down with an existential issue. You know, anybody else will take advantage of that. They haven't at the moment. And let's see how it plays out. But I've seen both the Houthis and Hezbollah, lots of fighting talk, but physically we've not seen anything more than normal.
Traditionally, pro-Zionist voices have always dominated the media, but this time around we're finding, maybe not on the mainstream media, maybe through social media, there seems to have been a shift, and pro-Zionist voice isn't actually now the dominant voice that we hear. What do you make of this?
So Yusuf, I think definitely this will probably be one of the major characteristics of this war, the information war, and how, you know, the Zionist voices have always dominated the information war. But what you're finding, Yusuf, is on this occasion, they seem to be losing the information war, and actually the job they are doing is pretty poor. And I think there's a number of reasons for this. Firstly, Yusuf, Zionists have always had a lot of influence and control the narrative when it comes to mainstream media. So, you know, your global newspapers, your media channels. But social media is decentralized. Social media is not controlled by any particular voice. So I remember, Yusuf, a few years ago, there was a uptick in violence in this town next to Al-Aqsa called Sheikh Jarrah. And there was this Zionist, he said, if I don't take your home, somebody else will. Now, if we didn't have social media, we would never hear about that. But people saw that and they're horrified. And a lot more people are seeing what life is like for Palestinians and what Israeli settlers as Zionists are really up to in historic Palestine. And that's a shock to a lot of people. So that's, I think, the first major change that we have. The other thing I think we've got to remember, Yusuf, that in Europe, we have a large left movement. In the UK, you know, you've got the Respect Party, you've got the left, you've got Labour. In France and Germany, you've got large lefty parties, and these have all been in power in Germany and France. So the left have always given a lot of airtime and support to the Palestinian cause, and they've always criticised the Zionist cause as well. So in Europe, we hear a lot more about the Palestinian side compared to America. Where in America, Palestinian voices are only now being heard. Previously, you would never hear a negative thing about Israel. The other thing is, you know, fundamentally, Yusuf, the original sin, if we go back to it, is Israel is a settler colonial nation. Now, how do you hide your settler colonialists? How do you hide you're carrying out a genocide? How do you hide you're slaughtering the indigenous people? And, you know, they did it for a long time. They were able to hide it and deflect. But the reality here is, how long are you going to hide it for? You kicked out the indigenous people. We know what you think about the indigenous people. We know what you want to do with the indigenous people. You're quite open. So what do you think was going to happen when you're openly saying we want to expel these people, when you're openly saying we want to drop a nuke on these people? You know, if you're saying that, people are going to see you for what you are, and this has an impact on people's morals. What we also find, Yusuf, is again, Zionists and Israeli officials, they constantly refer back and fall back to biblical arguments, the Holocaust, and that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. And this just doesn't wash with the people anymore. What people see is you're carrying out a genocide and everyone's watching it live, is being played out on TV, and you're trying to fall back on biblical arguments and the Holocaust. So, you know, people like Noam Chomsky, Norman Finkelstein, these are people who lost family in the Holocaust. They're coming out and they've always criticized Israel for what it's actually doing. In fact, Norman Finkelstein goes further. He actually says that Israel hides behind the Holocaust and uses it as a tactic to impose terror on other people. So, you know, if you massacred and slaughtered and expelled an indigenous people, I mean, how are you going to hide that? Those people are in Jordan, they're in Lebanon, they're in Egypt, they talk to the media. Now you're into second, third generation refugee Palestinians who can speak very good English, they're educated, and they're expanding the Palestinian cause. And I think the best example of this, Yusuf, is Piers Morgan. It's like he's been influenced now by the Palestinian argument. And he's quite open. You know, he always thought Israel was the good guy, Israel the democracy in the Middle East, and we should defend Israel. And even he started to turn, even he's realized, okay, I've never heard the other side of the argument. So I think tactically, Israel is struggling. But the reason why Israel is struggling tactically in the information war, Yusuf, is, you know, fundamentally their cause is one of settler colonialism, and no one will support settler colonialism. People have been victims of it. Many people in the West, they disagree with settler colonialism. So their cause in origin is something people will in the long term stand against. And after 75 years, that's where we are.
What do you make of the response in the UK? And where do you think it's going to take us in terms of our local politics?
So in the UK, I think every weekend now, you have demonstrations of over 100,000 plus in central London against what Israel is doing and support for Palestine. The political leaders, even the opposition in this country, they've come out openly. We support Israel for his right to defend itself. The Labour Party, who had the election in the bag, which is, what, nearly a year away, now there's question marks over it because many Labour councillors, Labour MPs and Labour supporters are like, we can't support you, Keir Starmer, if you effectively are giving Israel a blank check to carry out a slaughter. Obviously, so we've got to keep in mind, it was Britain that created Israel. It was Britain under its military occupation from 1917 to 1948 that facilitated the migration of Jews from Europe to Palestine. Britain has got as much blood on its hands as Israel has. You know, we use the example, the one who provides the knife to the murderer is as guilty as the murderer. That is a scenario. Britain's, and Britain was the one that facilitated and armed and created Israel, who's now carrying out these atrocities. So it's divided Britain significantly. What you're seeing now, the middle ground seems to be in the UK, a call for some sort of ceasefire or humanitarian pause. I think what the politicians have worked out, how can you show your support for the Zionists and show your support for the Palestinians, but without upsetting the Zionists? And what it seems to be is calls for humanitarian pause, calls for a ceasefire, calls for getting humanitarian food in, even having a corridor. This seems to be the middle ground they're coming up with. And obviously, Yusuf, a ceasefire doesn't deal with any of the underlying issues. A ceasefire is just a pause, and then you start again. It's not dealing with settler colonialism. It's not dealing with the expulsion of the people. It's not dealing with the original sin at all. So, you know, any call for a ceasefire really is quite tactical and pragmatic, and it doesn't really deal with the underlying issues. More importantly, Yusuf, Netanyahu has made very clear, we don't want a ceasefire. Why do we need a ceasefire? Because you've got to remember here, Yusuf, the Palestinian people and the Israeli Zionists, they're not equal. Israel is much more powerful, has more firepower at its disposal. The Palestinians are small and have no firepower. Why does Israel need to compromise when it's the more powerful person in this dispute? Why should it compromise and bring peace and not do what it wants to do when it's a stronger partner, when it can impose? And that's fundamentally the issue you have.
there's a lot of post-war plans that are flying around. How seriously can we take them? And where do you think this conflict is going?
US officials have been talking about this quite a lot. Even Biden said, you don't want to get into the problem we got in Afghanistan, where we invaded, but there was no post-war strategy. So the American officials, Antony Blinken, they've been saying this again and again, you know, what's your post-war plan? Your plan can't just be an invasion. It can't just be revenge. Otherwise, you're going to get into the problem America got into in Iraq and Afghanistan. There seems, Yusuf, about three plans or proposals flying around for what should happen after the war ends. So one of them is that there should be an interim Palestinian-led administration, and it would exclude Hamas. So there's a lot of talk that the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, they should run Gaza. That would be the best way to move forward. Obviously, the problem with this is the PLO have no credibility. They have no credibility even in the West Bank. And secondly, this would be seen as an external imposition upon the people. So it's unlikely going to survive in the long run. In many ways, it's probably the easiest to implement because the Palestinian Liberation Organization already exists. It already technically rules over the West Bank. So from that perspective, logistically, it's the easiest to actually do. However, in terms of the hearts and minds of the people, credibility is virtually zero. The second proposal that's going to be flying around is that there's a stopgap security and governance role for the surrounding Arab nations. So historically, what you find is whenever there's any talk of Palestine, two-state solution, roadmap, summit, the surrounding Arab nations are there to implement it and to give it oversight. So already the Israelis have said that when they expel the Gazans into the Sinai, Egypt needs to take care of them. If you think about it, Yusuf, when Israel was created in 1948 and they expelled the people went to Jordan. So today, 75% of Jordan's population is Palestinian refugees. They went to Egypt, they went to Lebanon, they went to Syria. So this isn't a new plan. This is actually a consistent plan the Israelis have had, that this is the surrounding Arab rulers, their problem. The Arab rulers have been very clear, they ain't taking anyone on. If you look at Egypt, Sisi has been very clear, we ain't taking anyone. This is Israel's problem. And Israel's got to come up with a solution which is indigenous to Israel. And then the third one, Yusuf, you've got is that there's some sort of temporary UN supervision of the territory. Again, the problem with this will be is credibility. If the Israelis rule over Gaza and the West Bank, it will be seen as a foreign occupation by the people. So the UN, how would that be different? So all of these plans, Yusuf, they have lots of shortcomings, but the main issue with all of these, Yusuf, is credibility. None of these regimes are going to work because they have lack of credibility. And America established a whole regime for 20 years in Afghanistan. It provided them with arms and equipment and aid, and it all suddenly collapsed in 2021 because they never had any credibility. So there is a historical lesson here for the West and the Israelis. Interestingly, Yusuf, all three of these post-war plans don't involve what do the Palestinians think, what do the Palestinians want. They don't even have the Palestinians at the negotiating table. And I think that's very interesting because the problem with Palestine has always been two-state solution was an American-inspired plan, and it was made the only plan because the Arab rulers surrounding Palestine accepted it. So what you're finding here again, Yusuf, is the Palestinian people aren't even being involved in how they're going to live in the future. And that probably means in the long run, all of these plans, if they're ever implemented, will actually fail.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolitics.com, all one word. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.